From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore the issues Milwaukee Public Schools is facing and learn what led to the resignation of Superintendent Keith Posley earlier this month.
There were severe problems within the finance office of Milwaukee Public Schools. One major problem was high number of vacancies, high rate of turnover, a lack of institutional knowledge, a lack of training.
We'll also learn about the politics of education in Milwaukee. Plus, we'll tell you about Milwaukee Film's Pride Month programming happening this weekend.
The mission of Genre Queer is to celebrate the past of film, enjoy and indulge in the present, and look towards the future. And I think that this program absolutely represents that.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. On June 4th, Keith Posley's 6 years as superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools came to a sudden end. He resigned after an hours-long closed-door school board meeting. This came after the State Department of Public Instruction announced that MPS was months late submitting required financial reports. DPI withheld millions of dollars from MPS because of the late reports. MPS is also at risk of losing millions of dollars because it submitted incorrect financial information for previous school years. MPS is working with DPI on a corrective action plan. Posley's resignation is effective June 30th, but finding his replacement is only one of the many mounting challenges ahead for the MPS system. To discuss Posley's tenure and some of the most pressing issues that need to be addressed, including rebuilding the community's trust, I'm joined by Alan Borsick. He's a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School and was a longtime education reporter for the Journal Sentinel, which he still writes columns for on occasion. Borsick begins by explaining what his initial reaction was to Posley's resignation.
When I first heard that they had not filed these audit reports with the state, I was totally floored. I mean, that was just like basic work 101 for this stuff. And at that point, it was clear that he had to go. I think there'll be more that'll go. I mean, he just had no base of support, not with the board, not with the public, not with anyone in the system.
So pretty unsurprising that he resigned after.
At that point, yeah. I was sure he couldn't last more than a few more days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, somebody had to pay the price. The problem is that firing him, and even though he officially resigned, he was fired. I think that's a much more accurate term. Doesn't solve anything in itself. In fact, in some ways, it makes things worse. Like, who's going to run the ship now?
Right. So do you think Posley was, as you said, someone had to go? Do you think he was unfairly scapegoated, or was this on him for not submitting these reports to DPI, or at least not notifying other people of the situation they were in?
Well, certainly it wasn't a one-person list of who's at fault. There's probably a long list of people who are at fault. But he's the captain of the ship, and the captain takes responsibility, you know. And he does deserve to take responsibility, be assigned responsibility for just really fundamental inadequacies in how they were running the place.
With those inadequacies, we should note that Posley did get $160,000 plus payout, including, vacation days he hasn't used. There's health care, some other things. Is that standard, or, you know, it's not one of the main points that come along with, oh, he's resigned?
It's kind of standard. His contract goes for another year, so he was shorted a year on his contract, although there were also provisions that for how he could be fired. So it's pretty standard. He was getting paid a little over $300,000 a year. $160,000 is really an underestimate because he got also $30,000 some in pension benefits, mm-hmm. plus unused vacation time and so on. I bet it's the final figure will be well over $200,000. And is that par for the course? Probably. Is that going to go over well with a lot of people, both within the system and out in the general public? No. I mean, you say, wait a minute, the guy screwed up the system, and now we're paying him a whole bunch of money to go away?
Yeah. Well, and this is on top of the public learning about the failure to submit required financial reports to DPI. This is right after a referendum for more money was narrowly approved. So, yeah, what are your thoughts on just the sequence of events that have happened?
Well, I hope there is a, shall we say, serious and level-headed and not just partisan and emotional examination of this question. I would venture to say that if the referendum were held today in the light of this coming out, that they've made major errors in their reporting, they're over 8 months overdue on submitting audits and such, very little question that it would get clobbered. And did either they or the DPI or both keep this quiet until after the April election? That's a really good question. I think there's a pretty good chance that might be true. Best as I can guess, undoing the referendum, having a do-over or holding back the money or something, that's going to be really hard, whether there's lawsuits, whether there's action in the legislature. Once you approve a referendum, I've just never heard of it being undone. So on the other hand, you ask me most anything about what's going to happen next in MPS, and my answer is, man, I don't know.
Before we get to, like, the big picture of what's next, you know, there's a theme of just general uncertainty. Even before these DPI reports or the failure to submit them, there's a lot of murkiness about what the referendum money would go towards and how it factored into, you know, the vacancies MPS has. And there wasn't a specific spending plan either. So was this a common theme for Posley's tenure, just a general lack of answers, explanations, and transparency?
I can answer that in one word, yes. And it goes back before him.
A clear answer.
Yeah. For reporters, people like myself or from anybody else attempting to cover MPS, they were so reluctant to give answers that you could ask them a question, it could be weeks before you got an answer. Once upon a time, you could go to schools, you could call up principals, you could, it was much easier to get things done, and the whole operation was much more open. Things changed when a guy named Greg Thornton became superintendent in 2010. And Dr. Thornton really wanted to have control of the message. And everything had to go through him and his very influential assistant. You could not call up people below them in the system. You couldn't call I remember calling up a principal and she started whispering to me, "I'm not supposed to talk to you." This is a public business. It's public education. So it didn't start with Keith Posley. Mm-hmm. But they were impossible to deal with. And I'm thinking of stories I wanted to do that were, in my mind, indisputably good things going on in MPS. I wanted to do a piece on the MPS just marked the 50th anniversary of its Montessori schools. They have the largest public Montessori program in the country. The schools are really pretty good. I couldn't imagine how I could make this a unhappy story. They wouldn't cooperate at all. I said, what's wrong with this? They were a tough bunch to deal with from a news standpoint. And that also applied even to people in the system, to the public
employees,
in general, to
parents,
to politicians. They did not like to get questions.
Yeah, and Posley, as you mentioned, what's the vision or, you know, is there something that will mark his tenure for sure? But I do want to note one of his priorities for success, as he called, did include, quote, ensuring fiscal responsibility and transparency. And apparently the MPS board claimed not to know the true financial troubles that MPS is facing. Does this tie into an overall closed off sense to access to Posley or information in general, if this is even within the board ranks?
Well, it ties into more things than that. There was a lot of turnover in central office in the time that Dr. Posley was the superintendent. I didn't keep score of how many finance directors and human relations department directors and all the other positions, academic positions, how many they went through, but it was a lot. And more so than I'm quite sure than in the past. And I'm not at all sure they had the A-team in there doing stuff. So that turnover and question of competence in the central office cabinet level positions is legitimate. But don't let the board off the hook either. The board hasn't been exactly jumping all over them to get answers.
To touch upon the board a bit, a lot of board members were teachers' union candidates, and you know, a lot of proposals aligned with union goals, which Pulsley never really pushed back on. So let's touch upon Pulsley's relationship with and to the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, the staff union here. What stands out to you?
Well, you know, when what was called Act 10 passed in 2011, and the state legislature, the great Civil War that took place in Madison over that, the Republicans who backed this, especially Governor Scott Walker, wanted to disempower the public unions and especially teachers' unions. And in many ways that happened, but Milwaukee is a place where it didn't really happen. The union does not have the same power over some things, but in actual practice, it pretty much does. The contract as it existed then largely is still the way business is done. And politically, the union is very influential. To their credit, they moved more into aligning themselves with other organizations in the community, to building coalitions and support. The union is very influential. And I believe 7 out of the 8 current board members are closely allied with the union or endorsed by the union. The previous president of the board, Bob Peterson, was a former president of the union. Missy Zombor, who's on the board now, previously worked for the union. There might be others. I'm not even sure. But there's not that much tension between the MPS administration and immediately across the street, the offices of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association. That's a pretty warm relationship, and that has a bearing on how a lot of things are done.
Right. So before we get into the bigger picture, I want to kind of rewind back to when he became superintendent in 2018. So Pulsley had been with the district his entire career. But in 2018, what was the context that he was hired into and some of the key challenges?
It wasn't very friendly. The then superintendent was a woman named Darian Driver, very talented person, was on a different page than the board. She was superintendent for 4 years. Tensions had been building, and then specifically there were differences over what to put in that budget. She wanted to cut teaching staff out in the schools and keep jobs in central office. She felt that was important to running the system well. That's kind of an interesting thought now that we've seen how bad the system is running. And the board was angry with her, and they forced her out. And Pulsley, who was near the top of the administration then, basically, best as I know, kind of behind the scenes, was telling board members, I'll do it for you. I'll do it for you. I'll cut central office and keep those teaching jobs, which was certainly the position the union supported at that time. So Darian was out, and Keith Pulsley was in another time when they acted at 2 or 2:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Keith came in as the guy who would do the board's bidding. In many ways, that's an important part of his legacy. He did the board's bidding. He was a survivor. He was very good at navigating the politics of a highly political operation, namely Milwaukee Public Schools Central Administration. He didn't change that much.
Yeah, there's just some of the main hitting points here. Obviously, COVID is a big, big component of his tenure, but he also, you know, reinstated a salary schedule for employees. As we mentioned, he led and passed 2 referendums, and he was also at the helm when a bill to split up MPS was put forth to the state, which wouldn't get passed because Evers vetoed it. But
right.
What else stands out to you about Pulsley's tenure?
Well, he had good goals. He had what he called the 1825 plan. 5 times 365 is 1,825 days. So from birth to 5 years old that's the number, 1825. And he called it the 1825 plan to emphasize early childhood programs, to try to get more kids on track to be ready for kindergarten when they walk in the door. You know, a lot of the gaps in success in education between rich kids, poor kids, minorities, whatever, those exist the day kids walk into kindergarten. And Pulsley wanted to address that. Unfortunately, I mean, some of that's outside of their realm. They have 4-year-old kindergarten, 5-year-old kindergarten, for that matter, to digress. The Head Start program, which they run about half the programs in the city, is also something they're under very serious sanctions for at the moment, for inadequate operations. So the early childhood situation, as far as MPS is concerned, didn't really get better, but he had that goal. He pushed what he called the 53206 initiative, which was to improve schools in that zip code, which is often considered the most troubled zip code in the city, the most impacted by poverty, and includes a list of schools that are almost all places with low success. And they brought in some extra social workers, psychologists, tried to strengthen staffs, all of which was probably needed. But the results in those schools haven't really changed. They haven't gotten better. It's ominous for the future of these children and for the city if we have that level of non-success in education. And it's something that isn't addressed very much. They don't like to talk about their problems, especially publicly, either the school board or the administration. And nothing changed. COVID certainly hurt. COVID hurt in terms of student behavior, student mental health, attendance. This was true nationwide, but it was really true in MPS.
I'm going to take a quick moment to reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us now, you're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski speaking with Alan Borsig, Marquette Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy, about MPS Superintendent Keith Posley's tenure and the challenges ahead for the Milwaukee Public Schools system. With Posley's main missions when he came in, some goals and objectives, do you think he accomplished what he wanted to? I mean, if we take away the way it came to an end, what significant progress do you think Posley made, or did he not, and why not?
You know, this is like the question you hear in political campaigns. Are you better off today than you were, in this case, 6 years ago? And politics would be 4 years ago, usually. And the answer is no, the system is not in better shape. The teaching situation, just recruiting teachers, retaining teachers, to be blunt, the question of quality of teachers is more urgent than it was then. That's not all Keith Posley's fault, but it's what's happened on his watch. They have had hundreds of teaching vacancies as the school year is unfolding the last couple of years. It's a system that's been held together in some schools especially, but even as a whole, by scotch tape and short-term solutions, using unlicensed teachers to cover classrooms, paraprofessionals
mm-hmm.
and others, and combining it's a system that's not in a super healthy situation, and it wasn't that. And that was true before some of these recent ominous things.
Right. Along the lines of criticisms, right, of MPS. Posley definitely had critics as well, of course, in some areas where, with not being aggressive enough about MPS's equity plans, there's the discipline disproportionality with Black students suspended at higher rates. And those numbers haven't really changed, even though MPS was under a civil rights orders to change this as well.
Right.
And, you know, at the end of this month, Posley will be out. And a new superintendent down the line will have to tackle a lot of these problems that have existed long before Posley. So talking about going into the future, what do you feel are some of the main challenges ahead for the district? And are we in a crisis mode? Because there's always been problems, and it's always seemed to be not addressed, kicked down the line. Do you think this is the one time where, as you said, there's a different kind of outrage?
There's a different kind of outrage. I'd agree with that. I think there's a new and deeper urgency about doing something, whether that's coming from either party in the Capitol in Madison, whether it's coming from local leadership. I mean, the mayor is, Mayor Johnson is beginning to talk more strongly about what needs to be done than has been historically true for mayors in Milwaukee going back many, many years. With one exception, the mayors in Milwaukee have generally wanted to stay out of MPS business, and Cavalier Johnson seems to be eager to get involved in some form, not taking over the district. So there's new urgency, there's new concern, there's certainly hot and very troubling issues on the front burner, the finance controls, the Head Start problems, the whole question of MPS revenue. My guess is that the short-term problems, including hiring a new superintendent, something will work out. It may not be happy, and there may be some costs to pay in terms of lost state aid for MPS. those will get worked out. But then there's a whole level of really big problems that are somewhat less tangible, but nonetheless hugely urgent. Just how are you folks going to get your act together? At the moment, the public probably pretty broadly says, these people don't have their act together. How are we going to convince people that this is a well-run and competent organization unless we bring in competent people who can run it well? And that's not the way it is at the moment. What are we going to do about the state of kids in the city? You know, how are we going to get kids engaged? How are we going to create what you would call a school culture? A lot of that involves building leadership, I mean, like principals. We need more A-level principals and not so many B and C-level principals. So how are we going to change the direction of this whole operation?
With this scandal, it's kind of, as you mentioned, reignited calls for the district to potentially be dissolved or be taken over by the city mayor, county executive. Do you think a dramatic change like this needs to happen? You know, what was your initial reaction to these potential solutions of breaking up the system?
Well, my main and probably most relevant reaction, I mean, I try not to take sides too much on things other than I'm in favor of kids doing well. But my main reaction is I don't think it's going to happen. Nobody's really talking about it. And to break up the district or to have a mayoral takeover or to do just something dramatic requires an enormous amount of energy and competence and unity. I mean, if the Republicans and the Democrats in the Capitol came together over a plan for MPS, that might carry some weight, but I don't think it's going to happen because they're all too busy hating each other. And most of the solutions that we're talking about so far, let's run the finances better, let's get the audits done, let's get a handle on some of these, just bad business practices that are going on. Those can be addressed, but they still leave that big wealth of issues unaddressed. And
do
I don't think anyone's is jumping in on that other than Tommy Thompson, who hasn't actually been governor for over 20 years.
Right. Well, and whether it's superintendent or, you know, they did have an outside person rush in to try and address these financial reports, right? But as we've been chatting, so many of these problems obviously don't end with Posley leaving. Would you say the main priority is more competent leadership? And in your column, you state, in general, getting the entire MPS act together. But they've always put out this front that the system is too big to fail. But I think it's coming up time for dramatic change.
We're testing that.
Yeah, we are.
I mean,
if this is not the time to test that, when will be?
That's for sure.
Yeah.
And I just had a conversation before we sat down here in which the question was, is this in effect a bankruptcy situation? Is MPS in need of the kind of help you'd get in a bankruptcy proceeding? That's a really good question to me. I don't know the answer to that. And I think some of that will depend on how strongly the school board responds. Some of it will depend on how strongly the city and state political structure responds. In a bankruptcy proceeding, they would maybe bring in someone like Governor Thompson. He was at the Milwaukee Press Club a few days ago, and he said he wants to see a special master take over MPS and run things until they get their act together. That's actually a pretty interesting idea. They need strong and good leadership right now. And if the people who are now in charge can't come up with it, things are going to get worse and something will have to be done about it. You got 60,000 kids in the basic MPS system who we, and I mean the big we, you, me, everybody, owe it to them to give them a good education. And if that isn't happening, even before all this blew up, maybe 6 months ago, I had a conversation with someone who's pretty knowledgeable about this stuff. And he said, what's going to happen when MPS gets to the point that it can't function daily, or at least that some schools can't function? They don't have enough staff. They don't have teachers. Sorry, folks, we can't give you an education today. That's not a frivolous thought. It could happen. We're closer to seeing that out there today than we've ever been.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know how to wrap up such a hard conversation. And I say this, you know, as an MPS alum, you know, too. I think we're at that point where it's like, are we waiting on their next move? Posley's one step, but...
Howard Fuller was a superintendent from 1991 to 1995, then became a big champion of school choice and so on, of course. And has many critics as well as me. But there's one thing Howard Fuller has said probably somewhere over a million times in the last 30 or 40 years that everyone should listen to, and that is, where's the urgency? Are we doing enough? Are we really serious about changing this? Because if we were really serious, we'd be doing more things than we're doing now. And now's the time when we say, okay, what are we going to do? If I'm going to end this on an optimistic note, to the best that I can.
I mean, it doesn't need to be optimistic.
No, but it's a pretty
real.
The optimistic tone here would be, aha, I really see the urgency. I really see the need. And it's time to do better. And it can be done.
I think that's a great note to end on. So, Alan, thank you so much for spending time with me today and for all your insights.
Glad to be here.
Alan Borsig is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School and has covered education for the Journal Sentinel, which he is still a columnist for. Borsig joined me to talk about Keith Posley's tenure and future challenges for the Milwaukee public school system, and you can find our reporting on this ongoing story at WUWM.com. In just a moment, we'll look more into what led up to Superintendent Posley's resignation. And later in the show, we'll tell you about Milwaukee Film's Pride Month programming. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We just heard about the resignation of Milwaukee Public Schools Superintendent Keith Posley and the struggles the district is facing. Now we'll dig into what led up to the problems at MPS and what's gone wrong with their finances. To help us better understand the local politics of MPS and who's involved in what happens with the state's largest school district, Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez is joined by Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Rory Linane to break it all down.
I think a starting point for a lot of people, myself included, might be just to understand the basic players and what they do. So can we start with a breakdown of what MPS's superintendent, school board, and DPI all do and how they interact?
At the top of who's most in charge of the school district would be the school board. The democratically elected school board is at the top of the chart, and they have control to hire and fire the superintendent. But the superintendent also has a lot of decision-making power. That person can hire and fire everyone below the superintendent and is in charge for the financial management of the school district, for putting together a budget. The school board ultimately can amend and approve that budget, but the superintendent is the one who's putting that forward. And then the State Department of Public Instruction has somewhat of a regulatory role or an oversight role, and they determine how much funding the school district is going to get from the state, although that's also determined by lawmakers.
You know, we're here because something within this relationship went terribly wrong. Can you just kind of high-level break down how did we get here and what happened?
So basically, there were severe problems within the finance office of Milwaukee Public Schools. One major problem was high number of vacancies, high rate of turnover, a lack of institutional knowledge, a lack of training for the staff in that office. On top of that, they were not using a good system for their accounting. So they had a software system that seemingly should be able to do what they needed it to do. They weren't using that system for everything. They were using like a series of Excel spreadsheets to get some of their tasks done. And that's what introduced a lot of opportunities for error, especially when you combine that with an inexperienced staff. So that has been a problem for over a year. More recently, the Department of Public Instruction, who needs these reports from MPS to put their aid estimates together, grew more frustrated because they weren't getting those. Not only were the reports late, but they were so late that it was holding up DPI from getting together their important aid estimates. And as this problem was escalating, this is where there seems to have been a breakdown in communication. So the school board was aware of some of the major problems in the finance office around staffing, but they weren't really aware, from what I've heard, about the problems around the software and the spreadsheets, and they also weren't aware that DPI was escalating and having daily meetings with administrators about how bad the situation was. So they were surprised, along with the public, in late May when DPI decided to kind of go over the heads of the superintendent and the administration straight to the school board and say, hey, you should know this is a big problem and we might start withholding your aid.
How unprecedented is it for DPI to go straight to the school board instead of interacting with the superintendent in the superintendent's office?
That they have not fully answered. We're still waiting for some clarity around that and when they have done that in the past, at what point they may have done that in the past. So I think that's where there's still some big questions and people want to understand why DPI waited so long to take that step. And DPI has said that it is kind of an extreme step to take, and they took it at this point because it got to the point where they needed the numbers to do their aid estimates, while others wish they would have brought this to the school board's attention earlier so that they would have had more time to start solving some of these issues before it got to this point.
Another part of this that I have to bring up to you, because when I first saw it felt like a draft of the correction action plan, which wasn't just one attempt, but even the second attempt, it was pretty embarrassing from what I had seen. And how did that happen? Who was responsible for that? And where does it stand now?
Yeah, so those first couple drafts, I don't know if they knew they were going to be made public, but when they were made public, they really tried to emphasize, you know, those were drafts. And they were put together by staff in the Office of Accountability and Efficiency, as well as the financial consultant that they brought in to help with this. Those drafts were really bare bones, lacking in a lot of teeth or information. But after those drafts, they submitted another one after some feedback from DPI, which are much more robust with specific timelines and goals and assignments of who's supposed to get those goals done.
The other thing is that this is all unfolding right after the referendum passed, which was a $252 million referendum, barely passed. And taxpayers are kind of filling in a gap of MPS's budget. And I attended last week's budget hearing where the upcoming budget actually passed. It was voted on and passed by the board. And a lot of community members were upset, I guess, to put it mildly, and use words like deceived, defrauded, lied to. What were you hearing about the referendum and MPS's finances a few months ago before we had heard anything from DPI, if you did hear anything?
At that point, I guess the main messaging was that state funding for public education has not kept pace with inflation, and MPS, like many school districts across the state, were needing to go to taxpayers to ask for more funding just to keep up with those rising costs. What wasn't very clear at that point was how messy MPS's accounting situation was. There had been public information about problems in the finance department, about understaffing, about late financial reports, but it wasn't clear at that point, especially that there had been errors, and definitely not errors of the magnitude that we're now just learning about from DPI.
So there's also been fallout from this, including some funding and people losing their jobs or stepping away from their jobs. What do we know there?
So the first person we saw lose a job after all of this was the superintendent. He decided to resign after a long school board meeting in which board members were discussing, you know, behind closed doors, the potential of terminating his position. But he decided to resign that night. The next day, basically, or that same night, very late, the chief financial officer signed a resignation form. But we didn't actually find out that she had resigned until more recently, when her resignation was effective. And then additionally, the comptroller for the district, he told me that he was fired from the district.
So I want to take you to the budget. When it did get passed, I was there in person. And obviously all of these board meetings and open meetings have been very contentious. And one person I talked to was Angela Harris.
Pro-public education supporter, Angela Harris.
The chair of the Black Educators Caucus. And something that caught my attention being there was that the union and educators in the Black Educators Caucus were not on the same page. And here's what she had to say about why.
I think for so long, the union was probably the loudest voice in that room. And a lot of times when the union comes out, it is often for bread and butter issues, which is paychecks and pensions and raises and things like that, and not for the actual things that the community is saying that our students need, which is more trauma support specialists, more programming like Black and Latino Male Achievement and gender inclusion and equity, and actually creating a budget that is built on equitable allocation of funding versus student-based allocation of funding. And so I think that's where you're seeing the clash happen, because today the union is asking for the budget to be passed on the mere fact that they, the district administration, has made this agreement with them, right, that they're going to get raises and all of these other things are going to happen. But they are not also asking for the transparency and accountability that the community is asking for.
I'm curious, what did you hear about why the union wanted to push this budget through? And again, something I heard a lot of in that room was there were still 2 weeks before the budget's due date. So basically 2 weeks to get a more complete picture of MPS's finances.
Yeah, what I heard from the union was that they wanted this budget to be approved as soon as possible so that staff would have some understanding of what their salaries would be for the upcoming school year, and principals could continue hiring for important positions in their schools without that kind of uncertainty. And especially, you know, with vacancies being such a big problem for Milwaukee Public Schools, I think they wanted to have that in place to keep that hiring going and keep staff confident in the district. But at the same time, we don't know how much funding MPS could be basically losing in the upcoming school year as a result of these errors. So there still are uncertainties, and there still is the possibility that there will be budget cuts before they, you know, finalize their budget in October.
Yeah, and you broke that story when this meeting was taking place. What are the financial implications? What do we know about happened there? And could there be more money lost?
When DPI first notified the school board at the end of May about previous accounting errors, they did say this could result in the district getting less aid in the next school year, because basically they were overpaid in the last school year because of those errors. You know, after that, eventually DPI said, we think maybe the consequence is going to be in the tens of millions. And then right before that meeting is when they gave me the estimate of 35 to 50 million. I did get to talk to the vice president of the board about those numbers right before the meeting, and asked how the board might handle that, because they do have a few options. Basically, they could still spend the same amount of money but take more money from local taxpayers to make up for what they're not getting from the state, or they could look to make budget cuts, or they could dip into their fund balance, like their savings account, to keep it going. And the vice president of the school board, Jilly Gokul Gandhi, basically said that they're going to seek to limit the impact on taxpayers. So if that is indeed the direction the board takes, that could mean budget cuts.
It's nice that folks are paying more attention to MPS and everything that's happening here, but so much to keep up with. One last thing is, Angela did have a parting note on, if you do feel like your head is spinning and are trying to make sense of this, there is help out there.
Definitely organizations in the city that are doing a really good job of informing the community of just the basic things, right? Like, how do you show up at a school board meeting? How do you testify? What are the things that you need to know? So definitely be on the lookout for those education groups. And then the news is also doing a really good job right now of keeping the community informed about what's happening as it's happening, which hasn't happened in the past in Milwaukee in terms of education. And so definitely pay attention to your news, pay attention to social media, and also don't be afraid to ask folks, right? Like, what is going on with Milwaukee Public Schools? Because everybody has a little bit of an idea, and the more information that we can get out to the community about what's happening, the better we all will be.
That was Angela Harris from the Black Educators Caucus and Rory Linane, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They both spoke with Leg Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. If you want to learn more about this issue, the Wisconsin Policy Forum put out a report that raised questions about the multi-million-dollar referendum that Jimmy mentioned in that conversation. You can find that at WUWM.com. Coming up after the break, we'll sit down with Milwaukee Film's genrequeer programmer to talk about the slate of films they have curated for Pride Weekend.
When else can you see these? You can watch these at home, and that's just fine. That is just fine. But there is nothing like sitting in a theater full of people, all going through the same experience, having reactions to things.
That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Earlier this month, Milwaukee kicked off Pride Month with Pride Fest at the Summerfest grounds. But that's not the only opportunity people have to participate and celebrate in Pride. Milwaukee Film's genrequeer program has put together a Pride Month 2024 program, which is one jam-packed weekend full of films that celebrate the past, present, and future of LGBTQ plus cinema. To learn more about it, I'm joined by genrequeer and shorts programmer Jack Feria. He begins by explaining how this slate of movies differs from what you typically see during the film festival.
Pride programming is great. We have incredible queer films at the Oriental and now the Downer Theater year-round, but something in particular is fun about hosting things in June. I've been saying, tis the season. This is the time to celebrate, so let's offer a way for folks to get in some air conditioning, break popcorn together, and enjoy some great films.
I love that, break popcorn together.
Absolutely.
Sprinkle that yeast, the celebratory yeast on
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
And so for this month, the Pride programming encompasses all different kinds of films from different points in queer cinema history, which I think is important to point out. So why was this perspective important to you? You know, we have things from the 70s all the way up to 2023, 24.
Yeah, the mission of genrequeer is to celebrate the past of film, enjoy and indulge in the present, and look towards the future. And I think that this program absolutely represents that. I thought it was fantastic that we were able to have the space to show films from the past. We get to show John Waters on the big screen at the Oriental Theater. Come on, that's amazing.
It really is. And with all the choices we have, right? What kind of decisions were you struggling to make in choosing films for this slate?
I mean, there were like 90 films that I wanted to show, like naturally. Like if I was just like on the couch and I had friends over, like there's a ton of films that I wanted to show. But I looked into films that had been in the area over the last few years and wanted to show stuff that hasn't been around in Milwaukee in a while. And we came up with this list.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of these films. We're going to start with a film from 1974 called Female Trouble, and it stars Divine. What's this film about?
Oh my gosh. So Divine is playing a high schooler wonderfully for her age. We love it. Who has had enough of her family and decides to run away and devotes herself to a life of crime and hijinks ensue. This is a film that I checked out from my local library when I was 8. I should not have watched this film when I was 8. Do not bring your
no
kids
children
to
this screening.
This is not Inside Out. No children, please. But this is one of John Waters' classic, wild, wacky films, made on a shoestring budget, and it's just one of the incredible films of queer cinema.
I love the descriptor in the trailer. It says, a new high in low taste.
The king of trash.
You know, John Waters is its own category, right? But with queer cinema, I do want to point out that, you know, especially from earlier decades, right? Some people might categorize these as B-movies or not high quality, but I want to point out that these films are being made despite a total lack of resources because studios and other production companies are not going to want to invest in making queer cinema.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. These folks do not have Fox dollars or Marvel dollars like we do today. This was just made, and you can see the passion on screen, and you feel it when you're watching these films.
Definitely. So up next, we have a film called Tongues Untied. This is from 1989.
Yeah, this is one of Marlon Riggs' most important documentaries, one of the most important documentaries, not just in queer cinema, but just in cinema, period. It is a seminal documentary on Black gay life, using poetry, personal testimony, there's rap and performances to describe the homophobia and racism that confront Black gay men.
And it's part of a double feature, right?
Yeah, we're showing two Marlon Riggs documentaries, so you can come watch Tongues Untied, take a short walk, and come on back for the second documentary, Black Is, Black Ain't.
Yes, and then we're going to jump to current modern-day film, quote-unquote. This was part of the festival, so if people didn't have an opportunity to see it, now is a great time as well. It's called Femme.
Yeah, Femme was the winner of our Emerging Fiction Award this year, played to two incredible crowds that we had at the festival. One of the most joyous experiences as a programmer is getting to hear and see reactions from the audience for certain moments and lines that you don't get to see when you're watching it on your laptop or you're just watching it at home. This is truly a come together and experience a ride movie.
Yes, and it is a thriller, so especially great for audience reactions.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we thought it would be so fun to throw in a thriller to, we have quirky comedies, incredible documentaries, but throwing in a thriller is really fun.
And what's the quick premise of the thriller, like the long game that's played out in this film?
Oh my gosh. So Aphrodite Banks, who's played by Nathan Stewart Jarrett, meets a character played by George MacKay, who you might know from 1917. They have a confrontation at a convenience store. George MacKay's character is incredibly homophobic. And later on, Aphrodite, out of drag, meets this character at a gay sauna and decides to create a relationship with him in order to find her revenge.
Up next, this is a very important film, especially for lesbian film history. It's called The Watermelon Woman, and it's from 1996, directed and starring Cheryl Doon.
Yeah, Cheryl Doon, who plays a documentary filmmaker who's making a film about a Hollywood trope in the 30s and 40s, incredibly racist trope called The Watermelon Woman. She is doing research on who this person was and along the way uncovers that there was an interracial relationship backstage in Hollywood. And around the same time, she's having a relationship of her own. Incredibly meta. This movie is so, so funny and so important. And I think that people will watch it and beyond the, again, like we've mentioned, lower budgets and all of those different obstacles in terms of making films, but it feels like a film that could be made today and would have the same impact. Yeah.
Yeah. And Cheryl Doon, and also shout out to Guinevere Turner, who's in this as well.
Yes.
Both of them really did a lot for new queer cinema and lesbian cinema history as well. So if anyone's unfamiliar with these women or its role in queer canon film history, definitely recommend Watermelon Woman for that.
And I promise you're familiar with Cheryl Doon's work. She has directed a ton of television, including recent episodes of Bridgerton. So you know Cheryl Doon.
You know Cheryl. So great example of like where she's grown from.
Oh,
right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And lastly, we have a bit of a local tie, which is great. There's a film from 2020 called Marky in Milwaukee.
Marky in Milwaukee was a film we had at the festival a few years ago. We were able to have the subject and the filmmaker with us. This is a fantastic documentary. Covers the life over the course of 10 years of Marky, who is going on a gender journey. As she moves about the world as a 7-foot-tall pastor, she faces challenges all throughout her life, including not feeling feminine enough, not feeling that she's presenting feminine enough, and starts to wrestle with the complications of her identity and whether it's worth it or not to continue on as Marky.
And the filmmaker will be in attendance for this, right?
That's right. This is a special memorial screening. Unfortunately, Marky did pass over last year, so we will have the filmmaker to introduce the film, share some stories about Marky that we don't see on screen. It'll be a lovely time at the Oriental Theater.
So obviously so many things to choose from and even more that we didn't have a chance to go over. But what's your call to action for people, whether they are part of the LGBTQ plus community or not, to come and see some of these seminal films from history?
when else can you see these? You can watch these at home, and that's just fine. That is just fine. But there is nothing like sitting in a theater full of people all going through the same experience, having reactions to things, nodding their heads, applauding, hissing even, all of those fun things that we welcome as a communal experience. Let's be a community together and watch these films. There's nothing like it.
Well, Jack, thank you so much for joining me today to share more about it.
Thank you. See you at the movies.
Jack Faria is the genre queer and shorts programmer for Milwaukee Film. He joined me to talk about their Pride Month 2024 program, which starts this Friday with screenings through Sunday, June 23rd, with the showing of Marquee in Milwaukee. Tune in to Lake Effect tomorrow to hear a conversation with that film's director. WUWM is a sponsor of Milwaukee Film's Pride Month 2024 program. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about a service in Milwaukee that supports people facing eviction. Plus, alt-rock band They Might Be Giants joins us ahead of their performances at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee this weekend. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.